You're probably familiar with the 20 questions game, where someone conceals the name of a person and others can ask simple yes or no questions in an effort to discover their identity. We're not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to be the one asking the questions, and they're anything but simple. I've put together 20 questions from ethics, broadly understood, since that's the area of philosophy I'm most familiar with. Unlike the game that you played on road trips to pass the time, the point of this exercise isn't to thwart efforts to come up with answers. Just the opposite. I'm hoping they'll actually prompt some of you to tackle one or another of the questions I'm about to pose. So rather than give a typical philosophy talk that tries to advance a novel thesis or an argument, I'm going to take the prerogative of my position to invite you to do all the hard work. I was inspired to put together the questions that follow by recalling a similar list that mathematician David Hilbert compiled and published in 1900. Hilbert's 23 problems helped set the research agendas for generations of succeeding mathematicians. I've got much humbler expectations for my list, but if it yields even a faint approximation of those results, I'd be deeply gratified. Since my questions are philosophical, not mathematical ones, they're not likely to admit of decisive resolutions as many of Hilbert's problems have done. And that actually leads to a bonus question, one that applies not only to moral philosophy, but to philosophy generally. Why is that? Why is there expert consensus that many exceedingly difficult mathematical problems have been decisively solved, while such consensus is far harder to find when it comes to prominent philosophical problems? That's question 21. Before I get to the other 20, let me say that I realize that the list I'm about to offer you likely reflects errors of both commission and omission. I may have included questions that, unbeknownst to me, have been answered actually in a fully adequate way. And my list certainly isn't meant to be exhaustive. There are questions that merit a spot here that but were left off, either because of my ignorance, frankly, or because I've mistakenly assumed that a given question has been adequately answered. For instance, your list might include the question, is morality ultimately grounded in our attitudes towards non-moral reality? I think I know the answer to that one, which explains its absence from my top 20. So without further ado, let me present my first question. Number one, what is the fitting attitude to have towards one's own mortality? Many of us, myself included, fear death. Some say that's impossible. We fear an outcome only if it's uncertain. And if anything is sure, it's that we'll someday die. I think it's not only possible, but actually perfectly reasonable sometimes to fear things you know are going to happen. Sam Scheffler, in his wonderful book about death and the afterlife, has convinced me of that. But suppose that's wrong, and it's a mistake. Let's just focus on a different negative attitude, such as trepidation, apprehension, worry, or anxiety. Is it appropriate to have such an attitude towards one's own death? That appears to depend on whether death is a harm. A further question, one that's not been much discussed to my knowledge, is whether that appearance of dependence is correct. Maybe it's not, in which case it might be fitting to have various negative attitudes towards my death, even if death isn't bad for me. Or maybe the appearance is accurate, in which case we have to solve a bunch of more familiar puzzles about whether my death can count as a harm to me. For instance, when does the harm of death occur? How can there be a subject of such harm? Since, as Epicurus said, where death is, I am not, and where I am, death is not. Is posthumous harm possible? And if so, how? And a question that's not, to my knowledge, been directly asked before. Is fear of death, when based on self-regarding considerations at least, just FOMO, fear of missing out? FOMO isn't a super savory attitude to have. If that's what our mortal dread amounts to, then perhaps we ought to do what we can to alter our attitudes. Finally, if different attitudes towards death can be fitting, perhaps it's appropriate to be anxious about one's death at some points, but to welcome it at others, then what explains this? If only one attitude is ever fitting, what explains that? As you can see, I'm actually in the business here of asking way more than 20 questions. For those of you who'd rather hear some answers, things aren't going to get any better, so you might want to hit the leave button now. For the rest of you, I offer my second question. Is being alive, no matter the experiential quality, intrinsically beneficial? In one way, I think question two is easy. If it's possible to be alive and yet permanently unconscious, incapable of doing or experiencing anything, then it seems to me there's no intrinsic benefit to being alive. I don't know whether the scenario I've just sketched really is possible, because I don't know what the analysis or real definition of being alive is. I also don't know what it is for something to be me. If all I am is a body, then perhaps I can be alive in a permanently senseless state, and the easy answer asserts itself. But if I'm at least partly some form of consciousness, then it's impossible to be alive and be permanently unconscious, in which case question number two becomes harder. Being alive is obviously a precondition of having good things in our lives. If I weren't alive, I couldn't experience pleasures or achieve anything. I don't think being alive is instrumentally valuable, and necessarily so much as an enabling condition for good things to positively contribute to our quality of life. To me, the difficulty of question two becomes apparent when we consider a person whose experiences are uniformly unhappy. Is there nevertheless something good in her life, her being alive, that can be placed on the other pan of the quality of life scale? Is there something to be thankful for? Not because she's hoping to one day enjoy positive experiences, but because the fact that she's alive is itself positively contributing to her well-being. Answering that question probably requires answering our third. And that is anything objectively good for you? What I mean to ask here is whether anything directly contributes to your well-being, though not in virtue of your attitudes towards it. Suppose you've achieved something quite special, such as offering a complete and correct answer to one of my 20 questions, but have come only to disdain your efforts and anything that's followed in their wake. Is your life nevertheless better off for your achievement? If so, how can that be? The attitudes we take towards our life and the things in it seem to have a bearing on our level of well-being. Other things equal, a person lives a life that's better for her if she's largely happy rather than morose, if she's interested rather than bored in her occupations, and if she loves rather than despises her family. So our positive attitudes can contribute to our well-being, but are they necessary for something to qualify as a positive contributor to our welfare? If necessary, are they necessary because they're the sole ground of that contribution? And if they're the sole ground of our well-being, what enabling conditions, if any, must be present in order for our attitudes of attraction, enjoyment, and the like to serve as such grounds? Those further questions are related to my fourth. What is the relation between living a meaningful life and a life that's good for the person living it? In its most general form, this question resolves itself into at least the following more complicated one. Is meaning a necessary condition, a sufficient condition, enabling condition, or an intensifier of a life that's good for the person living it? Here's a natural thought. This question's really hard because answering it first requires so much of us. We must first determine the nature of a meaningful life, then the nature of well-being, and then develop a theory of each that tells us the conditions and the grounds of meaning and well-being. That natural thought may be right, and if so, it would explain why it takes a lucky lifetime to be able to answer question four. But here's a wrinkle. It might be impossible to determine the nature of a meaningful life without first having at least a partial answer to this fourth question. To see what I mean, consider Susan Wolf's view that tells us that meaning is a matter of being attracted to things in your life that are possessed of objective value. Whatever the merits of her view, many in my estimation, it's notable that she begins with two assumptions, that a good life requires meaning in it, and that meaning is a positive contributor to one's well-being. She may well be right on both counts. However, note that the recipe I've sketched for answering question four requires us to remain agnostic about those assumptions, first developing accounts of a meaningful life and a flourishing one, and only then discerning the relations between them. Here's another way to put the difficulty. There are many conceptions of a meaningful life on offer, but it's not clear that they're all conceptions of the same thing. Those who think that our subject matter is fixed in part by the claim that a flourishing life must be a meaningful one may be analyzing a different phenomenon from those who suspend judgment about that claim. This raises a further methodological question. Are there any non-negotiable assumptions about life's meaning that we can enlist in order to help fix the reference of our investigations here? If so, do they include normative claims about the importance of meaning in a life? And if the answer to that question is yes, which such normative claims are the correct ones? let's now shift from a focus on ourselves and start asking questions about our relations to others. In my book, number 5 is really a toughie. Why and when is it acceptable to be partial to one's near and dear? Maybe I'm more narcissistic than the next person, but I'm including myself among my near and dear. Feel free to give yourself the same status when asking the question in your own voice. Start with yourself. If you and a stranger are equally in need of something in order to secure the same benefit, then you're morally permitted to give yourself priority when doing so is purely a matter of using your own resources. If you and I both need a knee surgery to remain active or a heart transplant to remain alive, you're permitted to use all of your available resources on your own surgery. That's true even if I'm a better person or a more productive member of society. The same holds for allocating resources to one's children, parents, or partners. It would be an unrecognizable morality that forbade you from devoting your resources to your child rather than a stranger if you're unable to help them both. Something tells me I'm going to get in hot water for that one. So, in any event, morality allows us to assign some preference to our near and dear. Why is that? I have no idea. In general, giving one person or group preferential treatment over another requires justification, which involves the citation of some feature that permits the differential treatment. In most contexts, we seem to be on very thin ice when the justification is because it's me, or because I care about him and don't care about her. Further, even if somehow we're allowed to prioritize our own needs and those of our loved ones over those of others, how far does this license extend? What are the limits of such preferential treatment? And why are the limits set where they are? Answering that last question will help us answer our 6th. Is killing an innocent in self-defense morally permissible? The late, great philosopher Judy Thompson thought so. She certainly wasn't alone. She took it as a datum that any plausible normative theory ought to account for. In licensing such conduct, however, we're given moral discretion to do something that's horrific. If we have such discretion, what explains that? Justifications of harming others involve at least 2 things. First, they identify a feature that gives someone standing to impose that harm. And second, they cite some feature of the victim that makes it okay that he suffer the harm. But it's unclear how to fulfill these conditions when it comes to harming innocents in self-defense. We can highlight the difficulty when considering third-party cases. If I see an innocent person threatening your life, I'm not allowed to kill him. Suppose you are, though. There's no feature of the innocent threat that differs across these 2 scenarios. So if there's a difference in the permissibility of killing the person who's posing the threat, it has to lie in a difference in standing. Suppose there is such a difference. The person whose life is being threatened acquires a license to kill, that standing, that no third party has. But why would that be so? To be clear, I'm not denying that it's so, but I have no defense of that position. And I certainly have no explanation of why that position is correct, if it is. Let's now shift focus from self-preservation to the preservation of others. Consider number 7. Under what conditions do the needs of others create strict duties of aid? I'm thinking of such duties as those that identify the aid recipient and the specific action required of you. Lots of people need help that I can provide. The same probably goes for you too. Clearly, I'm off the hook if what they need is beyond my abilities. Just as clearly, I'm on the hook if it's a one-off case of super easy rescue. Cue Peter Singer's pond example. But the verdicts in most cases aren't as obvious as they are in these clear ones. In fact, even cases of easy rescue aren't completely straightforward. With a minimal donation, I can save the life of a stranger. With a great many minimal donations, I can save the lives of many strangers. But there seems a point at which the iteration of easy rescues becomes sufficiently burdensome as to relieve me of any duty, at least for a while, to provide further assistance. When is that line reached? Why is the line where it is? And what of all the other non-easy cases? Morality does, after all, sometimes call on people to make great sacrifices, and some medium-sized ones too. If, as seems plausible, the needs of others sometimes fully ground a strict duty of aid, then when do they not? And what explains why we have discretion, when we do, to use our resources as we like, even if it means ignoring the needs of others? My surmise is that the answer to that question is going to have interesting connections with the answer to my next, number 8. Is there an ethics of attention? This may just betray my ignorance. Not just this, of course, but this may just betray my ignorance. But to my knowledge, there are very few philosophers who are having a go at this question. As advertisers well know, our attention's a limited resource. We can't look at everything. We're subject to information overload. Importantly, devoting our attention to others, their needs, the injustices awaiting correction, the opportunities for benevolence, is a precondition of making things better. And since we have moral duties to do that in one way or another, it seems that morality ought to have something to say about how we allocate our attention. Virtuous people don't look away from suffering, but neither can they stare at it all day long, not just because there are other things requiring our attention, but because for any ordinary person, combining a sympathetic nature with such sustained attention would undercut our motivation to get out of bed in the morning and do any good at all. To the extent that we can control what we attend to, what principles should guide us in deciding how to allocate our attention? Is it just one scarce resource among many, all subject to a uniform set of principles of distribution? Or is there something special about attention that creates distinctive moral problems that call for their own set of ethical principles? Failures of attention can explain some, though hardly all, of our misdeeds. Focus now on the larger class of culpable moral failings. Most people think that some sort of sanction, formal or informal, is in order. We might invoke a familiar thought that wrongdoers deserve to suffer in order to justify such sanctions. Is that familiar thought correct? That's question number 9, which is just, does any wrongdoer deserve to suffer? And if so, why? True confession, I have retributive emotions and intuitions. When I contemplate some seriously horrible character and he gets his comeuppance, I'm pleased. It strikes me as perfectly appropriate that he suffer for his immoral conduct. But I don't trust these emotions or intuitions, although I do trust others. If we're not morally responsible for our actions, then presumably no one deserves to suffer for their harmful or wrongful conduct. But suppose that I can, in whatever way is the relevant way, control my actions. And suppose that I exercise that control in ways that end up deliberately and gratuitously wronging others. While a variety of sanctions might be appropriate in such a case, why think that any of them is grounded in my deserving to suffer? More generally, what makes it the case that wrongdoers deserve to suffer for their wrongdoing? And a natural follow-up, if we sometimes do deserve to suffer in virtue of our moral malfeasance, what considerations determine the kind and amount of suffering that's deserved? One context in which this last question naturally arises is one in which two people with identical mens rea, situated in identical circumstances, perform some immoral action. Fortunately for one, no harm results. Unfortunately for the other, terrible harm results. Many of us will judge the latter person more harshly than the former. Can such an attitude be justified? In other words, question 10, does moral luck exist? Consider two thoughtless tourists, each of whom tosses a penny from a skyscraper observation deck before realizing how dangerous that can be. One of them kills a pedestrian below. The other does no harm. Should the lucky tourist be condemned and punished as severely as her unlucky counterpart? Moral luck is the phenomenon of being properly subject to moral assessment for things outside of one's control. As such, it's predicated on a deep sort of unfairness, and so it seems impossible. It's not just that moral luck doesn't exist, it can't exist, because morality, being what it is, can't embody and ratify unfairness. And yet, there seem to be apparently clear cases of such luck, as when we forgive, forget, and perhaps even celebrate a bit of morally shady behavior that yields a wonderful outcome. Maintaining a focus on harmless, though morally questionable behavior, consider this question, our 11th, one that I've been struggling with since grad school. How should we assess harmless, discretionary individual actions of a kind whose collective performance abets or directly causes substantial harm? I know this question doesn't trip off the tongue, but I think once you have it in mind, you'll see the force of how hard it is. And I'm going to try to get you to see that with an illustration momentarily. Here's the illustration. The sort of behavior I'm thinking of, it can be illustrated by a one-off purchase of a quarter pounder at a very busy McDonald's. Let me just introduce a few assumptions about the case. First, your purchase is wholly discretionary, doesn't satisfy a pressing need, but rather a desire that isn't very important in the scheme of things. Second, your purchase isn't likely to, and in fact, it doesn't make any difference to the amount of meat ordered by that restaurant, and so it has no causal impact on the fate of any animal. Third, no one does or is likely to learn of your purchase, and so it doesn't encourage anyone to follow your lead. In a case like this, which may be the typical such case, you haven't harmed or wronged any animal, and yet you're participating in a discretionary practice that, taken as a whole, imposes a vast amount of harm and is shot through with cruelty. The last point makes me think that there's something morally amiss with this action. But what, precisely? I don't know. Maybe there's nothing immoral about the action after all. Perhaps I should instead be diagnosing my unease by citing some defect of character. But if the action isn't itself immoral, then why is a trait that prompts it morally subpar? You might think that the sort of person willing to buy a quarter pounder is likely to be indifferent to the suffering of others and so be callous or cruel. But that's actually a tenuous hypothesis. Those who occasionally buy a hamburger might be actively engaged in combating injustice or preventing other harms. Though they may not be perfectly sympathetic or benevolent, no one else is either. So it's not clear that redirecting our inquiry from action to character is going to enable us to identify and explain what, if anything, is worrying about these sorts of cases. Rather than consider cases that might qualify as ones of harmless wrongdoing, I'm now going to invite you to reflect on a special set of undeniably harmful actions. If you're like me, you regard some otherwise repugnant actions as morally permissible, so long as they prevent extraordinary harm. If the potential benefits of doing so are great enough, it seems that morality might even license the deliberate killing of an innocent person. Suppose you disagree with that. This raises my next question, number 12. What, if anything, could explain why some types of action are never morally permissible? Those who believe that some sorts of action are always morally off limits owe us an explanation of this special status. I'm not asking what actually does the needed explaining, because I'm not assuming that there really are any absolute exceptionless moral rules. Rather, I'm asking what could possibly do the needed work. When I contemplate certain sorts of abhorrent cruelties, I'm tempted to think that nothing could ever justify their perpetration. They're intrinsically and essentially immoral, all things considered. But then I imagine a case in which, if I didn't perform one of those actions, someone else would surely perform 1,000 of them. What had seemed a principled righteous opposition to evil now seems a possible lack of courage. Shifting gears. My next question asks about the conditions of membership in the moral community. Specifically, here's lucky number 13, who or what has a claim to our direct moral consideration? And what is the ground of that claim? You're morally important in your own right. Regardless of how you figure into the aims of others, you merit a certain kind of moral consideration just because you are who you are. That goes for all your friends and mine. Not so when it comes to string or peanut butter or lava. Such things lack rights. We owe them nothing. Our treatment of them can't ground any complaint issued on their behalf. They have no moral standing independently of their relation to those who do. But what about fetuses, babies, non-human animals, plants, or ecosystems? The standard way to assign a moral status to such beings is by pointing to one of their intrinsic features and then elevating or demoting their moral status accordingly. But all familiar candidates, sentience, rationality, autonomy, self-awareness, communicative capacity, and so on, all these seem to generate false negatives, thereby excluding some who seem to be morally important in their own right. We might instead fasten on some relational feature, some extrinsic and relational feature to determine moral status, but these two seem fraught. We don't want to make the determination of a being's moral status dependent, say, on whether it's loved or useful to us, or instead unloved or useless. So in addition to trying to identify the extension of the moral community and the feature or features that ground membership therein, we should also step back and ask how, in the face of apparently intractable disagreement on these matters, we can make progress in answering both the extensional and the grounding questions themselves. Now, allow me to zoom out for a sec and ask not about anything's moral status, but a question about theory construction and evaluation in moral philosophy. Here's question 14. What are the criteria for identifying the correct normative ethical theory? How can we know it when we see it? Mine is a specifically epistemic question. I'm not asking what the correct normative theory is, though that's certainly an excellent question, one I'm happy to ask since I don't know the answer to that one either. But instead, here, I'm asking for the conditions of adequacy on such a theory, ones that, if met, give us excellent reason to think we've landed on the correct view of what's morally right or wrong, good or bad, virtuous or vicious. There are several theoretical virtues that apply to all theories, generality, internal coherence, external integration, etc. They'll be part of a comprehensive answer to question number 14, but set those aside for right now. Theories as such have explanatory aspirations. What are the relevant explananda for normative ethical theories in particular? And what features specific to normative explanations should we be looking for in assessing ethical theories? One familiar feature, reflected in most normative ethical philosophizing, is consonant with, or at least the absence of a clash with, our strongest moral intuitions. Even those who badmouth moral intuitions are likely to rely on them at some point in their theorizing, provided, of course, that they go in for moral theorizing at all. And I think they're right to do so, that is, rely on them, not diss them in a wholesale fashion. That attitude leads to question 15. What licenses us in trusting our moral intuitions, and what defeats such license? When I speak of moral intuitions, I'm not talking about gut feelings, hunches, predilections, emotions, dispositions, or tendencies of any sort. Nor am I talking about beliefs or other doxastic states. I'm instead referring to a kind of intellectual appearance, a non-doxastic phenomenological state in which it strikes you that something is morally so-and-so. Seeing an act of heartfelt kindness contemplating a narcissist's self-serving lies, I'm struck alternatively by the goodness or the badness of the action. Such intuitions seem to serve as good bases for moral knowledge, and they also seem to be plausible constraints on moral theorizing. Any moral theory that condemns such kindness or glorifies such lies seems a non-starter. It's clear, though, that my moral intuitions may not in every case tally with yours, and ours may differ in wide-ranging ways from those who live in communities that are radically different from our own. If our intuitions are meant to give us access to a moral order not of our own making, I know that's a big if, but one I'm willing to go for, then the breadth and depth of intuitive disagreement might give us pause, or various genealogies that trace the origins of our moral intuitions might be deployed to discredit them. It would be very good to know when, if at all, and why moral intuitions can serve as the basis for epistemic achievements, and when and why they can't. While I'm sanguine about the prospects of moral intuitions to deliver moral insight and knowledge, I believe that non-intuitional experience can do that as well. Moral intuitions aren't the only game in town. But how can these non-intuitional experiences deliver moral insight and knowledge? That's the next question, number 16. How does experience enhance the grasp of moral truths? There are innumerable types of experience. I'm asking about all of them, except the experience of having a moral intuition and the experience of forming a belief as a result of considering that the merits of an argument. Experience isn't invariably enlightening. We sometimes become more morally obtuse with age, but experience can, it sometimes does enhance our moral wisdom. Indeed, more than a modicum of life experience is required in order to have any moral wisdom at all. As Aristotle rightly suggested, we wouldn't seek the counsel of a child to help us through life's struggles. When we see a powerful movie that challenges our preconceptions, when we listen to someone who brings a fresh perspective to a topic, when we encounter a piece of journalism that disrupts our settled opinions, we're learning from experience. When we reflect on our near misses or egregious failures and realize the errors, not singular in my case, errors of our ways, we're learning from experience. The enhanced moral education that experience makes possible isn't typically a matter of assimilating propositions offered for our consideration. Does that mean that experience primarily contributes to moral know-how rather than propositional moral knowledge? Does it imply that morality resists strict codification in ways that other domains of experiential learning do? Let's move from moral epistemology now to moral metaphysics and consider this question about the foundations of morality. Number 17. How, if at all, can fundamental moral principles be explained? Fundamental moral principles are those that don't hold in virtue of any other moral principle or fact. In a forthcoming book with John Bankson and Terence Cuneo, we dubbed this question the arche question, from the Greek word for source. Unlike the other questions I've offered for your consideration, I actually think I have a good sense of how to answer this one, in large part owing to my having had a chance to work through it with John and Terence. Despite its importance, however, this question's been largely overlooked in the literature. I'm offering it for your consideration in hopes of spurring more work on it by you and others. To be clear, the arche question isn't asking for the identity of the fundamental moral principle or principles, nor is it asking us to justify our selection of one or more candidates for this exalted status. Instead, it asks why fundamental moral principles hold. What is it in virtue of which they obtain? I think the arche question is an interesting one only for moral realists. If there's no moral reality, or if any such reality is one that's in some way a function of the attitudes we take to non-moral reality, then the question I think is pretty easily answered. That said, it might seem an impossibility for realists to answer the arche question. Didn't Hume teach us that is's don't entail oughts? If he was right, then fundamental moral principles can't hold fully in virtue of non-moral reality, the is side of things. But being morally fundamental, neither can these principles, the fundamental principles, hold in virtue of other elements of moral reality. I don't see any wiggle room between the horns of this dilemma, so as a realist, I have to embrace one of them. Perhaps unsurprisingly, I think Hume was mistaken. If you want to know why, you'll need to read the book. As we near the end, I invite you to consider a pair of questions now about moral reasons. The first of these is number 18. What are the metaphysically necessary conditions for something to be a reason for an agent to perform an action? Can something qualify as a reason for you only if it's able to explain your action? Only if it's able to explain your action given your existing motivational profile? Only if it can be the content of a mental state that prompts you to act? Only if it's recognizable by you as a consideration that favors a given action? I could go on, but I'm going to stop here. Answering question 18 is important because of what I regard as a conceptual connection between reasons and the liability to blame. Namely, that one is blameworthy for acting in a certain way only if there's a reason against acting in that way. If meeting one or more of the conditions I've just stated really is required for something to qualify as a reason, then some bad actors are going to be able to immunize themselves from blame for some pretty nasty behavior, as their motivational profile will ensure that they lack reasons that oppose such behavior. Kate Mann calls such a view sad but true. I agree that it's sad, but I hope it's not true. Here's my next question about practical reasons, number 19. How can practical reasons from different normative domains be compared to determine their relative significance? I think this question is easier than it appears to be, just in this one sense. That's because of my view that not every domain that includes directives entails a correlative set of reasons. There may be no reason at all to adhere to the instructions of a club, the rules of a game, or the laws of the land. Despite our sometimes talking as if any normative system generated its own reasons, I don't believe that reasons come that cheaply. Still, I do think that there are at least prudential reasons, moral reasons, epistemic reasons, and instrumental reasons. And these can sometimes conflict. A natural thing to say is that they can be compared as to relative importance only if we have a common measure by which to compare them. I myself doubt that comparability requires commensurability, but if I'm mistaken about that, then we either need to find that common measure or abandon hope of making interdomain comparisons. I have no idea what that common measure would be, but I'm also unwilling to abandon the hope of comparing the relative significance of reasons from different normative domains. Indeed, I'm pretty sure that I know that such comparisons can correctly be made. Again, I expect a lot of flack for that one. We might expand knowledge. Here's why. Okay, I'll give you an example. We might expand knowledge were we to experiment on large numbers of unwilling human subjects. And that's some reason to undertake those experiments, but one that's surely outweighed by the moral reason, the competing moral reason, that requires respecting the informed decisions of others. That eating a chocolate bar would give me pleasure, that's a reason to do so, but if it belongs to a child who covets it, there's much stronger reason not to forcibly take it from her. I take these verdicts to be obvious, but they imply cross-domain comparability. So inter-domain comparability seems not only possible, but actual. And in the absence of any plausible candidate common measure, comparability plausibly doesn't require commensurability. But then how are we able to rightly compare the strength of reasons from different domains? I think that's a deep mystery. I'm going to bid you adieu by means of a final question, my 20th. Is there a single fundamental normative category? We can ask about relations within a given normative domain. Are, for instance, are rights reducible to duties? Are permissions, requirements, and prohibitions fully interdefinable? Or does one of these notions, or is one of these notions explanatorily prior to the others? But even after we've answered such questions, we can take a step back and ask about the relations between various normative categories. Are virtues, for instance, reducible to dispositions to do one's duty? Are values nothing over and above constellations of reasons? Are reasons themselves reducible to fittingness relations? More generally, does one normative category, deontic, evaluative, aretaic, fitting, favoring, does one of these underlie all the others? Charting this territory, I think, is fascinating work. There have been numerous efforts over the past couple decades to identify one category as the fundamental one. And there are yet more recent efforts to let a thousand, or at least a handful, of flowers bloom, arguing for a plurality of categories at the fundamental level of normative thought or reality. As with all but one of the 20 questions I've laid before you, I have no idea how to resolve question number 20, but I'm eager to see the results of the efforts you're going to put into it. A good list is a provocation. If you work outside of ethics, I hope you might be inspired to create a list of your own. If you're an ethicist, I'd regard it as mission accomplished. If you're encouraged to get to the bottom of one of these questions, or sharpen my statement of it, or come up with other questions that deserve our sustained attention. Speaking of which, thanks for sticking with me and sustaining your attention throughout this talk.